When it comes to delivering customer support, there are some things you don't want teams to hear. Intercom's streamlined support platform clears up space for more organized workflows and peace of mind. Our business messenger uses chatbots, shared inboxes, apps, and more. Who doesn't like the sound of that? Intercom. Less of this. And more of this. To learn more, go to intercom.com/support.
You know, I'm right. Nick Durst here with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, we have a great author on for our guest today. I want you to let everybody know who we have with us.
Yeah, he's got a book coming out in December called The Ambulance Chaser, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But he's also authored a couple of other books and definitely has had quite the interesting life. And somebody like me who has dealt with stuff pertaining to that and has had a dad like with those issues that we're going to talk about, really, really excited to have him on. He's a practicing attorney based in the Dallas area, and he's a motivational speaker. So really, really excited to have him on. He happens to be the brother of a certain person out there who's quite famous. And again, really, really excited to have him on, Brian Cuban. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be on, guys. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Thanks, Brian. We're glad to have you on here. And we just want to, get to know you a little bit here and then, of course, talk about the books. But got to start off with the childhood. What was that like? Were you big into sports? And when did you say, hey, maybe I want to pursue some sort of career in the legal field?
Sure. And just for your watchers, so they don't keep staring at my eye instead of listening to us, I had an intimate relationship with a bedpost at 3 a.m. So I found out the hard way that I, in fact, do not know my way around my bedroom in the pitch dark.
There you go. Brian was not in a boxing match with the Paul.
I'm not a Star Trek Next Generation Borg or putting on a Mike Tyson tattoo. But I was born and raised in Pittsburgh. I'm the middle of three boys. A lot of people know my brother, Mark, the Shark Tank and the Mavs. And I have a younger brother, Jeff. I'm the middle, and we had a pretty normal relationship growing up, pretty normal childhood. I'm a baby boomer, grew up in the time when cell phones were two cups attached to a string, where Social Network was playing dodgeball on the blacktop basketball court. So a bit of a different world, but I was also a heavy kid. I was bullied severely, fat shamed. I was even physically assaulted over my weight. And it's kind of an interesting story, I won't go into all, but my brother Mark had given me a pair of shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants. And this was in the era of Saturday Night Fever. Mark taught disco, believe it or not. And, but these pants weren't really, they fit Mark fine. And I had to jump up and down, spray the water bottle. My butt looked like 15 cats back there trying to get out. But I wore these pants to school and the kids made fun of me. And one day they decided I was too, quote unquote, fat for these pants. And my stomach was hanging over and my butt was huge. But I didn't care because I love my brother and he loved me and he gave me these pants. And they ripped the pants off me and on a busy street, tore them into shreds down in my Fruit of the Loom tidy whities, my Pittsburgh Pirates t-shirt, my Keds tennis shoes and tube socks. Remember, this was the 70s. And went on like they had done the funniest thing ever. And it was very traumatic. And it was around those kind of things that kind of formed those adverse childhood experiences that kind of formed the accumulation of snapshots of what I would become later in life. And that translated into alcoholism starting at Penn State, two eating disorders, bulimia and exercise bulimia. I would discover cocaine in 1987 and become addicted to cocaine. I would take my first of two trips to a psychiatric facility in the summer of 2005 after a near suicide attempt. Three failed marriages, all revolving around drugs and alcohol. One more, I get a free set of steak knives. And then jail. And then finally in 2007, I would begin my recovery journey. And in all that mishmash of dysfunction, I had some years I was able to manage some years as a successful lawyer, just kind of fell into them. But I lost my law practice and was literally being supported by my brother, Mark. Yeah, and I was, we should talk about privilege. I have a lot of privilege. I have skin color privilege. I have financial privilege. A lot of people don't have that. And I would be disingenuous not to acknowledge the privilege I've had both in life and recovery and in addiction. They say addiction doesn't discriminate, but in an essence it does, because it discriminates based on, it impacts communities of color differently. It impacts different demographics differently. So it can hit anyone, but in terms of its impact, it kind of does discriminate, as does recovery. So I became a practicing lawyer, lost my law practice. And then I decided, as I went into recovery in April of 2007, I really began to discover who Brian Cuban is. Somebody who never wanted to be a lawyer, and somebody who had a story to tell about everything I have been through in terms of trauma, in terms of resilience and building resilience. And so I began to blog about my eating disorder. Guys don't really talk about eating disorders. And that was my first really experience blogging about my struggle with bulimia into the advocacy world. And then people were like, wow, Mark Cuban's brother struggled with an eating disorder. Men struggle with eating disorders. And so I became a fairly sought after speaker, especially on college campuses. And I've kind of aged out of that now. There are younger people struggling with eating disorders who speak on college campuses. But that led into my first book, which was Shattered Image, which was about my struggle with body image. And then came my second book, The Addicted Lawyer, where I wrote about my struggles as a lawyer struggling with cocaine addiction and alcohol addiction. And that book became very popular within the legal community and recovery community, and was kind of the springboard of what I do today, which is a recovery speaker doing a lot of work within the legal community. And go on.
No. It's definitely a lot to unpack. So at the top, I mentioned stuff that you have gone through. I have also been through. I think Nick has also been through a couple of these things. I think, speaking on my behalf anyway, I know I grew up with a lot of self-esteem issues. I was always consistently kind of like the chubby kid, the overweight kid. I was always somebody who, despite like being very athletic and being very into sports, I was always like the afterthought, the kid who was picked last. My parents are divorced, and my dad has battled very, very similar demons as you, especially with the alcohol. He's been to meetings before, you know, years ago. Thankfully, he's fairly clean now. Also had a gambling addiction at some point. So we previously had a guest on with us, Craig Carton, who now works again at WFAN here in New York. And he was somebody who kind of battled very, very similar things. And that was the first episode that I really came out and talked about stuff like this. And so I wanted to say that although a lot of the overlap isn't necessarily, you know, entirely what you have gone through, again, there are other people out there who have experienced stuff similar to you, kind of had things going on in their head similar to you, know people close to them who have been through things that you have been through and understand the battles that you have been through and understand that sure. Just because you win a battle doesn't necessarily mean you're going to win the war. So let's get back on track here. I just kind of wanted to
sure. And I am a friend of Bill's. I got sober in the rooms. And when I first went into the rooms, and for those don't 12-step recovery, the most well-known is Alcoholics Anonymous, but there are other forms of 12-step. One of the things I learned is that, well, we all have different stories. That, you know, I traded 2007. I traded Mavericks championship tickets, for cocaine. And so we all have kind of unique facts, but in the end, bottle to mouth, glass to mouth, powder up the nose, or whatever your drug of choice is, it's tends to be the same dynamic in that regard. So I played some rugby at Penn State, and but I really was never, I'm a huge Pittsburgh Pirates fan, massive. Sorry to all your listeners. you know, we can talk about Garrett Cole. I see
you're not our first play Pirates fan. Now we've had some Pirates. This guy is great. This guy loves his Garrett Cole, unfortunately, but I don't know. The Pirates just seem to be, they can't get out of their own way right now.
Oh, it's brutal. It's brutal. I mean, I went to my first Pirates game with my father at Forbes Field in 1969. I saw Tom Seaver pitch against the Pirates, and I've been a fan ever since. So, I mean, I'm 60. How many years is that, right? That's decades, multiple decades I've been a fan. Yeah. And so I've been a fan through the good times and the bad times, but I bleed black and gold. I'm a Steelers fan. I'm a Penguins fan. But I think Pirates are who I consistently just live and die with.
So wanted to get back on track here and talk about your law experience. And so you went to University of Pittsburgh School of Law.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I am reading, from what I have read, a lot of stuff that you practice directly relates to First Amendment stuff, speech, hate speech directly. A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned that you are somebody who has been privileged in your life to be able to be, to have access to the resources that you needed at the time to help guide you back on the path that you kind of wavered off. So there are a lot of other people who don't necessarily have those types of privileges, and there are people who take advantage of those privileges. So, you know, as somebody who has the experience that you do, seeing people in those types of positions, is that what kind of motivated you to kind of study and go in that direction?
The first thing that motivated me was cathartic, healing myself. And so it started with, and I think a lot of recovery journeys and recovery books tend to start that way. They tend to be journeys of self-exploration. But as I found recovery and went through recovery, it just, I was able to really reflect on the people I've lost to overdose, like the friends I've lost to overdose, the friends I've lost to alcoholism, the struggles I've seen within the legal profession. We have the highest rate of alcoholism of any white collar profession, over 20%, up to over 30% when you compare that to the national rate of about 12%. So the struggles I saw, it was something that I wanted to shed light on. Especially within the legal profession, we tend to take advantage of vulnerability in our profession. We don't allow ourselves to be vulnerable, which is one of the reasons I think our dysfunction rate when it comes to drinking and things like that is so high. And I really wanted to just try to impact one life at a time. If I can tell my story in one person, if 99 people say whatever, pound salt, and one person seeks help, is able to find recovery, decides to not end his or her life by suicide in that minute and seek help, or encourages somebody to reach out to someone, then what greater gift is there? I'm Jewish, and there's a Jewish kind of Kabbalistic phrase called tikkun olam. It means changing the world with acts of kindness. And that is what I try to do, my little part of it.
Yeah, and you know, you definitely did a great job of trying to, you know, give advice to people, get your message out. So tell us about when you were hosting Cuban's Legal Briefs for Eye Opener TV. How did that opportunity come about for you? Like doing TV.
A woman interviewed me for a local station, and at the interview she said, you know, we're about to do this legal show. It was called Eye Opener TV, and we've seen some of your rants and things like that I was doing on Facebook and things like that, and we think you'd be a great host to have this little segment. And that's how it started. So it was a lot of fun. The TV station is now defunct. Eye Opener is defunct. But it was a lot of fun recording those little videos. I did it on the Penn State scandal, the Jerry Sandusky scandal. I just picked all of these hot topics and would just rant about it. And I would scream. And it was, I was kind of like the, who's the Kramer the guy that rings all the bells, right? The business guy that rings all the bells and stuff.
Yeah, Jim
Cramer. Kind of like the Kramer of legal pundits screaming at television.
Who knows, Joe? Maybe one day we'll follow in Brian's footsteps and be yelling on a television show of our own. So, Brian, how did you, start getting into the, you mentioned you're going to campus and speaking. That's not something where you're like, you just say, I want to speak. Usually you got to find some sort of speaking agency or you got to do a lot of outreach. How did you ultimately get into getting those bookings?
A lot of that is privilege again. When I wrote Shattered Image, I had a PR firm take me almost pro bono because the founder of the firm in New York had struggled with body image issues. So he said, this is an important issue. And I got a lot of coverage with the last name of Cuban. So that was kind of the springboard of that. And
Hey, Jen, we need to sell our home. Do you know a great agent?
I do. We just sold with a local Redfin agent. It was awesome. And we paid a 1% listing fee because we bought our new home with Redfin, too.
Wow, 1%. Are Redfin agents full service?
Totally. Our Redfin agent did it all, and we sold for thousands more than the home next door.
I'll check out Redfin today.
1% listing fee when purchasing with Redfin, subject to minimums, terms, and conditions. Does not include buyer's agent commission. Learn more at redfin.com or call 844-759-7732.
And before I knew it, people were reaching out to me to speak. And that was my entree into the public speaking profession, which is now to the extent of, to a big extent, non-existent now. It is because of COVID, other than, virtual presentations, but it is not the same. So we're all, the public speaking profession has undergone, is in a major depression, major recession. I would even call it a depression. Because of that. But that's how I got into that. School started reaching out to me. People started reaching out. My first event I ever did was a young lady reached out to me to do an event in Winnipeg, Canada. And that was the beginning of my speaking career.
So public speaking is incredibly difficult because number one, you have to have the confidence to be able to go up and speak in front of people. And coming from the background that you did, going through the things that you did, a lot of stuff directly related to your life. If you were to go up naked in front of 50 people, that's remarkably hard to do. You have to be able to find the confidence to be able to do that. What inside you basically made you want to go out and share your story and kind of break that barrier between you and everybody else?
I can answer that with a short story. When I first started out, you have to practice. Speaking is an art. You have to practice. And I practiced by speaking at Rotary clubs. Right? You go in, you can make mistakes, and it never really gets beyond that. And you get a free breakfast or a free lunch. So I went into the Rotary clubs and was practicing, and all these Rotary clubs around Dallas. I had finished the first ones I had done, it was speaking about body image and shattered image. I walk in and it was a bunch of 60-year-old people my age now, 60-year-old men. And I'm going to come in here and talk about eating disorders. Talk about a tough audience. So I give my spiel and I couldn't get out of there fast enough because I'm thinking no one's going to be interested in this. And they were receptive. And a lot of them came up to me and said, I have grandkids or I have children who are struggling, thank you. But I got home, and there were some lawyers in there too. I got home and I went on Twitter. And I received a tweet from a young lady, didn't know her from Adam. And her tweet said, you don't know me, but my father was at your talk today and we are having dinner together for the first time in a year. Part of my talk is also my relationship with my now deceased father and his impact in my life. Those are the kind of moments that just tell me that I have to get out there again. Because you never know what lens somebody is going to look at you through. I talk about bullying. I talk about depression. I talk about alcohol. I talk about self-image. And you just don't know. Everyone will see you through their own life experience lens. And they'll hear and they'll take in the bits and pieces of your talk from their life experience. And that is just so empowering and makes me so grateful. And I get messages and emails every week from somebody who saw a talk on my YouTube channel or was at one of my presentations or saw me tweet something or post something. And there are so many people out there, and you just know that you're changing lives in one degree or another. Yeah. I mean, how can I not want that?
Yeah, that's what it's all about. Now, you continue to change lives through your books. Your debut novel, The Ambulance Chaser, is now available for pre-order.
Yes.
On paperback, and it's coming out in December. And a little bit about the book for our listeners. It's Pittsburgh personal injury lawyer Jason Feldman's life. It's turned upside down when he's accused of the murder of a high school classmate 30 years prior. He is now a fugitive from justice and is looking to find the one person who can prove his innocence to save the life of his son. Brian, tell us a little bit more about the book. And I see you right now, you're hustling, you're on social media platforms, well, promoting everything. How has that been going for you?
It's been going well. The book is doing very well on Amazon. My publisher is thrilled. I don't think it's ever, and I'll watch it, it's probably dropping right now, but I don't think it's ever gone above 5,000, below 5,000 of all books ranking Amazon rankings in 2 weeks. So it's marketing is a full-time job. I will never say a nasty word about a marketer again. I am learning. But it's been going great. The book actually came to me in a dream 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. It was a weird, I dream a lot. I'm a vivid dreamer. I remember almost all my dreams. And I had a dream that I was with a high school classmate throwing bodies in a bonfire in Pittsburgh. And and then I was suddenly my age, thinking about whether I was ever going to get arrested for those bodies. Now, I've never thrown bodies in a bonfire. I haven't murdered anyone. But it all started from that. It all started from the dream about a character, as a lot of books do. And and so, as you might expect, in the protagonist, Jason Feldman, there's a lot of me in there. He has his struggles with addiction and things like that. But I'm excited. It's a quick-moving legal thriller. People ask me if it's John Grisham-like. I hope it's Brian Cuban-like.
Yeah.
I don't want to be anyone else, right?
You want to be the only you.
Yeah. I don't want to be emulating anyone. And you have to remember, I forget how many it is. There are literally, and here's a tidbit for you, there are literally only 8 or 9 plots in the world. You could go through any movie, any book, and it's going to be, and we have what's called the hero's journey and different things. It's going to be this, 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 or this. There's nothing different, right? There are only new characters. There are twists. But as far as story plots, there are only 8 or 9. Everything's been done. Everything.
Right.
You will. So.
I mean, the majority of movies or TV shows, it's boy meets girl, boy and girl fall in love, boy and girl get married.
That's it. Like mine. I mean, I had someone say to me, "This is a fugitive ripoff." No, it's really not. But is it a kind of a similar plot? Well, yes. There are no new plots.
Right. Right.
There are no new plots. Dead body coming back to haunt the guy in the present is not new. What is new in our characters, right? You create interesting and compelling characters and put them in interesting and compelling situations. That's what you do.
No doubt about it. So everybody go check out the Amazon pre-order right now for The Ambulance Chaser. And it's coming out in December. So we wish you the best of luck with that. Brian, wanted to ask you, just because you kind of mentioned a little bit about the Mavs earlier, what do you remember about the night when Mark's Mavs finally won an NBA championship?
I was there. I was there in Miami, and it was incredible. We went down on the floor, and Mark was up on the stage in the middle with Dawn Carter and Tiffany, his wife, and everyone. And I was with my wife, and we were down there. And it was just surreal. It was surreal. What was funny was afterwards, we're in Miami, and they all went to this club called Live. And at this point, it's, 2000? I'm only 4 years in recovery now. I went into recovery in 2007. So we went, and he had this table at this club called Live, and I'm not drinking, and obviously. But the marijuana smoke was so thick in that club that we had to leave because I was afraid. I have no problem with marijuana. I mean, whatever. It wasn't my drug of choice. But I was afraid I was going to be high by the time I left. that's what I remember, is that you could not see 10 feet from all the marijuana smoke in Club Live that night. And the streets of Miami Beach were deserted. and it was surreal. They were deserted because
the players, the fans were leaving the games early. I mean, it was wild.
And there was no one celebrating in the streets.
No doubt about it. And I want to just ask you, what you remember about this time when it seemed like the MLB owners kind of colluded against your brother. They didn't want to let him in.
The Cubs.
To own a team.
Cubs, that's right.
I think, I mean, the Cubs broke the curse, but they would have broken it a lot earlier, I think, if Mark was in charge. What do you think about that whole scenario there?
I mean, there are so many scenarios I look back at with Mark and things like that. Everything works out for the best, right? Do you have time for a quick story on how things work out for the best?
Yes.
God.
1999, the Pittsburgh Penguins, the guy, owner Marino, I think his name was Ed Marino, filed bankruptcy. He was the owner of EMC. Put the Penguins into bankruptcy. The Penguins are in serious danger of moving, I believe it was to Ottawa or somewhere. They were going to be moved to Canada. I got an email from an old law school buddy, and I'm here in Dallas, and that sucked, but it was what it was, right? I got an email from an old law school buddy, my law school roommate. He said, do you think your brother would be interested? And this was before he bought the Mavericks, obviously. Do you think your brother would be interested in trying to keep the Penguins in Pittsburgh and buying them? And Mario Lemieux was also trying to buy them because he had a huge contract invested and he was going to lose all his money in bankruptcy. He was their biggest secured creditor. So I was used to forwarding emails to Mark from people and, you know, and no. So I forwarded him the email and I got an email back. Well, who do you know? Whoa, okay. So before I know it, I'm in Pittsburgh, kind of as Mark's point guy, meeting with all of these people to try to arrange with Mark to cut a deal to buy into the Pittsburgh Penguins. This was around April 1999, and you can look up the articles on Google. And so Mark comes into Pittsburgh. We drive out to meet Mario Lemieux. He made me wait in Einstein's Bagels while he met with Mario Lemieux. And this was before cell phones and really with the internet, big deal before you had all of these things. We still had the internet, but there wasn't really Wi-Fi either. So I was just sitting there twiddling my thumbs. And we're driving home and I'm thinking there's a deal. Mark's on the phone about wiring money into his account to do the deal. I mean, yes, I'm going to move back to Pittsburgh. And never heard much more about it. I went home, I flew home. And a couple of days later, it came out that Mark had decided not to do the deal for a bunch of different reasons. And so that all fell through. But Mario Lemieux bought the team. I believe they won at least 2 Stanley Cups during his ownership tenure. So that worked out, right?
Right.
And so now we're into the summer of 99. And guess what happened in January of 2000? Mark bought the Mavericks. If Mark had ended up as a part owner of the Penguins, would he have bought the Mavericks? I don't know.
I think so.
Everything works out for the best.
I absolutely did. Last question for you here on Mark. You know, you probably get this sometimes, but I just want to know, which decade here do you think Mark is going to run for office, potentially?
Yeah. President? You know what? I have a fast and solid rule of never speaking for my brother and trying to read his mind.
Yeah.
I could restate what he said publicly. It's tough when you have kids to do something like that, especially in this age when you've seen the vitriol, you know, that comes out politically and when, you know, we're in the COVID era. It's just, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. So I honestly don't know. And I love my brother and I support him in whatever he does, whether it's a run for president or whether it's whatever he does in his life.
What I will say quickly about that is I think there are a lot of people in this country who are having a changing viewpoint on how they feel their representative or where their representative should be coming from. And I think a lot of people will look to somebody with the credentials that your brother has for higher ranking positions like that.
I honestly don't know. Who knows what the world's going to look like the next election cycle, right? It's just so hard to predict things. It's funny. being a baby boomer, I grew up when there were two newspapers or two local newspapers and four television stations. So that was your news. That's how you consumed your news. You weren't scrolling on Facebook or Twitter or wherever, you know, wherever people go to scream at other people, right? So it's interesting. And who knows what things will look like in 2000, whenever the next election is. And so it's hard to say. Whatever he does, I love him and I support him.
As you should. Hopefully the Cubans become a household name here. And
I hope I'm a household name on the New York Times bestseller list or some bestseller list.
Absolutely.
Yes. And Nick and I are very happy that you took some time out today to join us. We really, really appreciate it. Everybody, look into Brian, look into the books, look into the Cuban Foundation too, because I know you've done a lot of work with that as well. And what Nick and I do is we always give our guests the last words. So on top of that, if there's anything else you would like to share, yeah, if there's anything else you would like to promote, you have an unbelievable story. It's unique to you. A lot of things that you've gone through, again, like you mentioned previously, are not stuff that are necessarily unique to you. People have battled what you have battled in life and maybe not entirely the same. But again, if there's anything else you would like to share, promote,
you were struggling,
please go ahead.
If you are struggling and feel alone, you are not alone and you are enough. Reach out to somebody, reach out to me, and I'll help you find the resources to find a path. Recovery is possible. It's not easy. It's scary. I've been terrified of it at times, but it's doable.
All right. Great last words there, Brian. We appreciate it. That's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right. For our very special guest, Brian Cuban, and for my co-host, Joe Calabrese, I am Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.
The been thinking about McDonald's all day, can't get it off my mind. I can already taste it. Ooh, got my mind on my mouth and my mouth ready for some Mickey D's deal.
There's a deal for every moment at McDonald's.
Right now, get two of your favorites for just $3.50. Mix and match a classic McChicken, a hot and spicy McChicken, or a juicy McDouble. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal. Single item at regular price.